So thank you so much for having me today. And this is just a stunning place. I would imagine that, you know, at least for me, this is the same way that going to Legoland would be for my kids. It's a great place to be. The picture we have of galaxies, such as our own Milky Way, is one where the visible stuff, stars, gas, planets, is embedded in a big halo of dark matter whose fundamental particle nature is unknown. We have overwhelming evidence that, in fact, in the universe as a whole, 4 out of 5 grams of matter are made of dark matter. Also, there's rather conclusive evidence that the dark matter is made out of a new and yet undiscovered elementary constituent. It's a new elementary particle. So what is an elementary particle? Suppose you're an elementary particle theorist, you're on a date, and your date asks you, okay, what do you do? Well, I'm an elementary particle theorist. So what's an elementary particle? There's a great way to have that date end up in a disaster, which is often the case, is to tell the truth. The truth is that an elementary particle is an irreducible unitary representation of the Poincaré group. So that's, you know, there's a few exceptions, but usually this kind of makes the date end in a disaster. So what is an irreducible unitary representation of Poincaré group? Well, it's something that is classified generically by two numbers, which tell you how the particle transforms under boosts and under rotations. So one number is the mass, and the second number, which is integer, half integer, or if you ask Philip, maybe if m is equal to 0, it could be more interesting, that tells you how the particle transforms under rotations. So is this new dark matter particle coupled to the visible world, where as far as we know, it doesn't have to. It really doesn't have to. But if it is, chances are that the particle might disintegrate somehow and produce stuff that belongs to the visible sector, stuff that we can measure. There's two ways in which a particle, dark matter particle, can disintegrate. Either it decays or it pair-annihilates. And this notion that we can do physics with the debris of dark matter particles that are disintegrating is what I'll be telling you guys today in my seminar. There's two things that are particularly interesting in the debris of dark matter particles disintegration. One is antimatter. And the reason why antimatter is interesting to look at is twofold. Well, it's primarily because antimatter is very rare. And secondly, we know how it's produced in cosmic rays in a galaxy. However, antimatter positrons or antiprotons is stuff that carries electric charge. It gets bent as it propagates in the magnetic fields of the galaxy. So you don't have directional information. The second thing that is interesting to look at is photons. And photons have this great property that more or less they travel in straight lines and that they don't lose energy as they propagate. However, there's a lot of things that produce photons. So you get a battle with background. This, in a slang of this field, is called indirect dark matter detection, or astrophysical dark matter detection. And my research is about whether or not we can do fundamental physics with indirect dark matter detection. In other words, whether or not we could do fundamental physics, we can understand things about elementary constituents and their interactions from astroparticle or astronomical data. Now, is this possible at all? Yes. There's plenty of evidence that in the past, we've been very good at doing fundamental physics with astronomical and cosmic ray observations. Antimatter was discovered in cosmic rays. The fact that the standard model comes with copies of matter fermion generations was discovered in cosmic rays. Pions gave the first clues as to how strong interactions work. And again, they were discovering cosmic radiations. Much more recently, we found out that the standard model is missing a piece in a neutrino sector. Neutrinos have mass and they mix. And that was also discovered in cosmic rays. So why should the particle theorists care? Well, first of all, because, as I said, we have been able to do fundamental physics with cosmic rays and gamma rays. But secondly, because, as we were discussing with Mina yesterday, we are a data-starved field. We need data to work on, to think about ways in which the standard model is enlarged to encompass new physics, how to go beyond the standard model. So when I moved to the United States about 10 years ago, there were a lot of things that I did not quite understand about the country. One of these things was the notion of chasing ambulances. I just didn't know what that meant. But then I got to understand what it means. And somebody said something interesting to me, which is, you'd better only chase ambulances when the patient is not dead. Okay, so you gotta chase the right ambulances. And that's one of the things that I like to do when it comes to thinking about fundamental physics from the sky. So one of the most popular signals that over time have been attributed to dark matter is the so-called cosmic ray positron axis. Let me be quantitative here. Popular means that about 1,200 papers have been written about these excess positrons in the 10 to 100 GeV range being produced by dark matter particles. So a lot of interest. And one of the reasons why this was and still is a very hot topic is that a rising positron fraction, in other words, an increase in the ratio of the cosmic ray positrons to the sum of the positrons plus electrons in a cosmic radiation, was envisioned as a smoking gun signal for dark matter annihilation or decay in the galaxy a long time ago by folks like Mike Turner and Frank Wilczek. And one of the things that made this a smoking gun was the fact that if you pair annihilate dark matter particles, then you get electrons and positrons with an energy at most equal to the dark matter particle mass, because to a good approximation, dark matter in the galaxy is non-relativistic, and so if it annihilates, you know, center mass energy is twice the dark matter mass, you produce any plus, any minus. So you have a cutoff at the dark matter particle mass. It's a great smoking signal because it also informs you about where the dark matter mass is. So now, interestingly, back in 97, Heat, Bloom-Born experiment, first detected a hint of a rising positron fraction, and this was followed in 2009 by results from a Russian-Italian satellite-borne experiment called PAMELA that reported quite conclusively an increase in the positron fraction, followed by Fermi, and this is something I was directly involved in, and it's really very, very interesting because Fermi is a gamma ray detector that works by detecting pairs of a plus and a minus, and so it also detects electrons and positrons, but it doesn't have a magnetic field. So how did they measure the positron fraction? Well, in a very smart way. So they used the fact that the Earth shadows some of the incoming electrons or positrons, depending on the trajectory and the energy of these particles. You can predict whether or not the detector is seeing an electron or a positron. And so in that way, you can actually reconstruct, if you have a good enough model of the Earth's magnetic field, the positron fraction itself. And that measurement is a little bit offset. It's shown here in blue, but it's roughly consistent with this notion that there is a rising positron fraction. And AMS really put the last nail in the coffin and with very large statistics showed that indeed we have a rising positron fraction. So why is this remarkable? Well, it is remarkable because we think that most of the positrons in the galaxy are produced as a result of inelastic collisions of primary cosmic ray protons, accelerated, say, in supernova remnant shocks, that hit gas in the ISM. And as a result of that inelastic collision, you produce pions. And among pions, you've got charged pions that decay into muons that eventually decay into electrons and positrons. So these are secondary particles. So secondary means that they're produced by primary cosmic rays that have traveled in the galaxy, spent some time, that diffused, lost energy. Some of them are lost outside of the galaxy. And then they hit, the ISM and produce these secondary particles. So the physics of why you have a decreasing positron fraction as the result of pretty much any secondary to primary ratio prediction is simply that the diffusion constant is not a constant. Particles with a large energy, diffuse more. They escape the galaxy more efficiently, just a result of the fact that the Larmor radius is a function of energy, ultimately. And so it's a very universal prediction. So having a secondary to primary ratio increase with energy means that there's something different in the way cosmic rays are produced. So there is an excess over the standard, standard prediction. So what are the caveats? Well, there's basically two caveats. Number one, you can have some sort of reacceleration of secondary particles in situ, meaning that wherever you produce these secondary particles, you still have some steam that you can give to the secondary particles and you reaccelerate them before injecting them in the ISM. But that is something that we can actually test using different secondary to primary ratios. In particular, a smart thing to do is to look at the boron to carbon ratio, because boron is a nucleus that is also only synthesized by secondary processes. And so by looking at B over C, you can test whether or not there exists some sort of reacceleration of secondaries before ISM injection. And we don't know yet whether or not this is ruled out. There's no indication that B over C increases with energy, but AMS data are not available yet about B over C. So the jury is still out there, but perhaps the most by far plausible explanation at this point is that there's something else that produces this 10 to 100 GeV positrons, some primary source that adds on to the secondary production. And it turns out that pulsars, the magnetosphere of pulsars, is a very natural place where positrons are made. I pointed it out a long time ago, back in 2008, when Pamela first came out with the data. With my student, former student, Tim Linden, we showed that you've got perfect fits to the positron fraction data using existing pulsars that we know where they are, we know how much energy they lose, and we know how the spectrum of these electrons and positrons more or less should look like. And remarkably, these fits basically don't have any free parameter. They literally almost have no free parameters. For example, in one slide, I will explain where this cutoff is as a function of pulsar age. So that's a fixed thing. I don't get to play with where this cutoff is. I don't get to play with the slope. I don't get to play with the normalization much, because the normalization is fixed to the spin-down luminosity of the pulsar. A fraction of that luminosity gets turned into pairs producing a magnetosphere. So it's a hard, it's a very constrained game. So there's new data from AMS, and they are also perfectly consistent with the pulsar picture. So the cutoff is not a smoking gun for dark matter. So the AMS collaboration has made a lot of noise that, oh, we are observing this cutoff. We're observing with the new data some sort of a hint that the positron fraction is cut off there. But that has nothing to do with dark matter, as far as we can tell, because it only has to do with the fact that that energetic electrons and positrons lose their energy very efficiently. In fact, at high energy, the rate at which they lose energy is quadratic in energy, and that is because of two processes, inverse Compton scattering and synchrotron radiation. They're both quadratic in energy. So if you calculate the maximal energy that an electron or positron can have after a given amount of time, that's finite. Okay, that's finite. And the maximal energy is just 1 over the age of the pulsar times this coefficient B. Okay, so the cutoff you don't get to play with, because it's just dictated by the pulsar age. So in fact, if we did in fact observe a cutoff, that would just help us pinpoint better which pulsars might be responsible. So it's, at the moment, there's no definite place for the cutoff in current data. But roughly speaking, the age is between 10 to the 5 and 10 to the 6 years, which is the age, you know, kind of middle age pulsars have that age range. And we know that E plus and E minus are trapped likely in pulsar wind nebulae for 10 to the 4 years. So that's great. So these are not super young pulsars, young enough that we don't expect these things to be injected in the ISM yet. So known pulsars are okay. And there's some gamma ray pulsars that were discovered with Fermi that might also contribute, but we don't have a problem there. On the other hand, explaining the positron axis with dark matter is not easy. Okay, but for theorists, problems are opportunities.
Can it be pretty blunt? So, like, how far should the pulsars be?
Great. Thanks for asking. So that's also important because you want these things to get to you in time. So the range is between 100 parsecs and about 8 kiloparsec. Okay. So there's a finite number of pulsars in that sphere. There could be some that we don't see in radio. And so that's why with one of my undergraduate students, we looked at gamma ray only pulsars. We know that the gamma ray cone is wider, much wider than the radio cone. And so it might very well be that the important contributor is radio quiet. So it's important to look at different frequencies. Yes? Great. So AMS has these interesting marketing strategies, and part of that strategy is saying that there is an antiproton axis. So I don't think there is an antiproton axis. I think that there are more antiprotons than what old models, you know, 10-year-old models of cosmic rays in the galaxy were predicting. But there's absolutely no problem. Actually, less than 24 hours after AMS came out with the data, there were papers explaining what that measurement of antiprotons implies for cosmic ray models. Yeah. So it's not problematic to match those antiproton data with ordinary secondary production. It carries information. And I'm not here to say that AMS is doing useless science. It's doing very interesting science. It's selling that science in a peculiar way. But,
can I just ask quickly about
yes?
Coefficient B on the previous slide, do you know that that's a constant?
So there are corrections to that. Coulomb scattering doesn't behave like that. Bremsstrahlung doesn't behave like that. But in the high energy regime, that's correct.
Okay, so it doesn't depend on the magnetic field or something.
It does. Yeah. So B encompasses a quadratic dependence on the magnetic field. So you've got a dependence on many things. Inverse Compton depends, of course, on the target density of photons linearly. And the synchrotron emission depends quadratically because it depends on the magnetic field density. It depends quadratically on some sort of effective average of the magnetic field. And so that's inside B. And you can imagine that, of course, how well do I know B? Well, you know, it's up for grabs. It depends on where you look in the galaxy. But
I'm just trying to check how conservative the estimate is. So is B using the magnetic field measured today, or is it using some extrapolation of how the magnetic field scales into the past?
So it's used, what you use is something that, you know, refers to local magnetic fields. Like I said, answering Nyayesh's question, you're talking about stuff that is within 1 kiloparsec. So, you know, you use maybe 1 microgauss or a fraction of a microgauss. Yeah. Yes. That's correct. So a secondary production.
It's really already in the background.
Yeah.
But even if it was an excess, it could even be justified not necessarily by that quantity, but by other optical phenomena like
the random. Yeah. Yeah. So another way to put what you just said is that there's standard secondary mechanisms, the standard production mechanisms for antiprotons that perfectly well match observations at this point. You don't need anything else. So that's different from the positrons. Because the positrons, you don't really have the luxury of explaining them with standard mechanisms. So theories, problems are opportunities. In fact, there's a general theorem called Redmond's theorem that says that any competent theoretician can fit any given theory to any given set of facts. And I'm sure this was verified in this place many times. So what does that mean? In particular for the positron fraction. Well, for example, we realized that you need dark matter to annihilate a lot, very efficiently, much more than you would predict, say, if dark matter were a thermal relic. So how do you explain that? Well, people have come up with very interesting scenarios that have really revolutionized the way in which we think of dark matter. For example, we realized that there might be a velocity dependence in the perannihilation cross-section of dark matter, perhaps because there's a Lie mediator that mediates the perannihilation of dark matter. Maxime and others, and of course, Philip and Talia have worked a lot on this. And so the Sommerfeld enhancement then opened up a whole Pandora vase of model building, which, you know, has been tremendously important in the development that the field has taken. Also, you need to suppress hadronic annihilation modes. And again, there's been a lot of model building on how to think about models that prefer leptons to hadrons in these leptophilic dark matter models. Also, you need to hide secondary radiation. If you produce high energy charged particles, which are light, you produce a lot of secondary radiation, just out of Bremsstrahlung, inverse Compton, and other things. But one thing that we did with one of my students was to observe that, well, maybe you can just close the loop and produce two photons in the final state. And, you know, you can actually attach something meaningful to these blobs in writing down a set of the lowest possible dimension effective operators that do this for you. And then what you can do is say, okay, I know that we don't observe gamma ray lines, and so I can translate that into constraints on models that give an explanation to the rising Poisson fraction. And if you do... Right, the Lie mediator would not fall in this category. But of course, you know, you can think of many models that, that boil down to this sort of effective...
Do you have any models that would actually explain the positron axis with the point interaction?
Yeah. Yeah. In principle, you could. In principle, you could. So, for example, and yet being consistent with other data. Yeah. So, in fact, it turns out that some of these models have a combination of velocity suppression and p-wave suppression such that this is actually a relatively small amplitude. And so you're okay with pretty much any you know, constraints from gamma rays.
But where would you get the range for the
positron? Well, yeah, I mean, you would need a pretty small, yeah, I see your point. Yeah, so you would need a relatively small mass scale associated with these effective operators, for
so
sure.
What is the,
and you wouldn't explain the thermorelic density either.
Right.
And you wouldn't explain the relic density.
Extra,
ingredient to produce the...
Component.
That's right. So, of course, our intent was not to come up with yet another model that explains the positron fraction. The idea here is that you can relate in sort of a quote-unquote model-independent way a line with monochromatic leptons.
What is the signal?
It can be very small. I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but if you want to explain a positron fraction, it's, you know, you need 10 to the minus 24 centimeter cube per second. So it's a small scale. So, but importantly, you know, suppose you have a good model that explains the positron fraction in terms of dark matter. How you tell that apart from pulsars? Well, for the longest time, I was convinced that a smart thing to do would be to look at the directional information that you get out of measurements of E plus and E minus. So if it's a pulsar, you should get a preferential arrival direction from the direction of the pulsar. No dipolar anisotropy has been detected so far, neither by AMS nor by Fermi, which actually does a much better job than AMS. And that's fine with a pulsar interpretation. In other words, you don't expect large enough anisotropies from existing pulsars. And actually, I've shown that if an anisotropy is ever detected, then you conclusively would rule out dark matter. And the reason is that the best thing you can do to fake an anisotropy with dark matter is to have a nearby clump of dark matter. But if that's the case, you would have seen that clump in gamma rays. So there's a no-go theorem there. And so if you detect an anisotropy, you kill dark matter. However, life might not be so easy. In fact, a student of mine at some point asked me, okay, what's the effect of magnetic fields close to the sun, so in the heliosphere? Would they mess things up? And yes, they would. So magnetic fields in the heliosphere, we've estimated, on average, would deviate positrons with an energy of about, you know, 10 GeV by 90 degrees, okay? And that's preliminary work. That's just a regular component of magnetic field. We know there's a significant turbulent component in the heliosphere. But the bottom line is that things get scrambled just to the level of the heliosphere enough that probably direction information is lost anyways. So it's a tricky job. What do we have left?
What is assumed in this plot?
So in this plot, you wonder, okay, let me inject an electron with an energy of, say, 10 GeV, and let's simulate where it goes as it winds through the magnetic fields of the heliosphere, and which direction I detect it at Earth. And so the average, you do that for a bunch of different positrons or electrons, and the average deviation is on the order of 90 degrees. And again, this is preliminary because this only assumes a regular component magnetic field. Now we're doing Monte Carlos with, you know, moving towards the full turbulent magnetic field structure in the heliosphere. And so things might change, but I don't expect the bottom line to be significantly different.
So what about the rest of the galaxy? I mean, there is magnetic field everywhere. So.
Absolutely. So do we believe that we might indeed get direction information? I mean, there could be bubbles. We know that there are microscopic, you know, magnetic field bubbles, and we might even be inside one. So this is just a proof of principle that using direction information, while it would indeed kill the dark matter hypothesis, might not be, in fact, feasible, unless you go to very high energies, maybe. So a long time ago, there was this Franciscan monk that said that entian assum multiplicanda preter necessitatem, which means you shouldn't multiply entities beyond necessity. You know, you've got pulsars, and pulsars work. So do you really need to postulate dark matter? And here's a rare picture of the same guy looking perplexed at 21st century particle theorists working on dark matter. So just a couple of weeks ago, I was interviewed by Wired, who wanted to report on the AMS results. And so they've got this article, science is closing in on dark matter, but we are the hype. And I was quoted to say that there is absolutely no reason to think AMS results have anything to do with dark matter and new physics. And I stand by that. Okay, I stand by that. There's no reason to think that AMS results have anything to do with new physics. It is interesting physics. We are learning stuff. We know more about cosmic rays than we did before, but there's no hints for new physics there. So there's been a lot of hype during the last few months from the discovery of 3.5 keV X-ray line. Folks here like Itai thought about it, and this hit the news pretty hard. Sky and telescope, mysterious X-ray lines, my hint at dark matter, Universe Today, GizMag. Then there was one that really caught my attention, was the Register. It said, boffins say dark matter fine with X-ray. And I'm like, I've been in this field a long time. Who's this boffins guy? I've never heard of it. So, from the Second World War, that's how they call nerds, is my understanding. Right? Is that correct? Yeah. So that's what boffins. But apparently it's no longer derogative, is it?
No, it's an egghead.
Okay.
It's a common phrase in the British tabloid press. Boffins by now.
So here's the story. So back in 2014, Bulbul and others, Harvard folks, they discovered a line at 3.5 keV from stacked clusters of galaxies and X-rays, and especially from one specific cluster, the Perseus cluster. Then folks in Europe, Boyarsky and company, found the same line, again in Perseus, same data, not surprising, and then also from M31. Then with Gelteam at Santa Cruz, we looked at the galactic center, and we're like, well, if it's dark matter, it should be in a galactic center, and there it was. So we discovered a line at 3.5 keV in the galactic center, and then Boyarsky also looked at that, and they also found a line there. So this is interesting because X-ray lines are predicted for a very well-motivated class of dark matter models, sterile neutrinos. So these are sterile in the sense that they're gauge singlets, but they might have a mixing term through a mass term with active neutrinos. Somebody at Queen's with Scott Donaldson explain how you can produce sterile neutrinos in the early universe. Now, this production mechanism is better known as freezing, but that's their old story. So they might even be connected with baryogenesis. And the thing is that if you've got a sterile neutrino, it mixes with an active neutrino, and it can radiatively decay into an active neutrino plus a photon. And so since the final states are massless, The photon has a monochromatic energy equal to half the mass of the stellar neutrino. Okay, that's great. So 3.5 keV lines might be compatible with a 7 keV stellar neutrino decaying through that diagram. So the bad news is that X-ray lines are also things that you get from atoms.
That's a very good news. Otherwise, it would be, have a very hard time doing astronomy.
that's a very good point. That's a very good point. That's good news and bad news, I guess. So if you calculate what's the 1p2 1s energy of a z equal 20 atom, that's roughly 3.5 keV. So you expect stuff like potassium or calcium or sulfur to produce lines in that energy range. So here's something I learned working this project, that atomic physicists are crazy. So this 18 means the following thing. It's a potassium ion with 18 minus 1 electrons missing. Okay. So if you do a calculation, that's a helium-like atom. So they could have called potassium 2 because it has 2 electrons. No, it's potassium 18. Anyways, so potassium 18 has a line that is almost exactly a 3.5 keV of energy. So, of course, the question is, how do you tell that line apart from this really cool stellar neutrino line? Well, the name of the game is to predict the brightness of the potassium line using other elemental lines. So you observe a bright line and you try, okay, maybe using that line I can predict the brightness of the other potassium line. Or maybe I can use another potassium line, but unfortunately there's no really bright potassium line that you can use to gauge again. So there's two key complications in this exercise. Number one is that, as you can imagine, these ions are immersed in a plasma that is at some temperature of order keV. And so the rate at which you jump atomic levels depends on temperature. And you don't know the temperature. And presumably, there's actually not a single temperature. There's pockets thermalized at different temperatures. It's a complicated problem in that respect. Number two, you don't really know how many potassium nuclei you have per, say, calcium or sulfur or whatever else you can observe that produces a line in that energy range. So the Harvard folks argued against a potassium line based on the fact that in their estimates, that line was not bright enough by about a factor of 20. Okay, where a factor of 20 was based on relative elemental abundances normalized to the one place where we know the relative elemental abundances, which is the sun. Okay, is there any reason to believe that when you stack 70 clusters together, the relative elemental abundances are like the sun? No, there's absolutely no reason. In fact, if you talk with people that work on supernova explosions, they will tell you that if you just fiddle a little bit with initial conditions in your supernova, you predict factors of 10 different relative elemental abundances. So it's really pretty unknown. But
have you observed, other than simulation, have you observed the difference in the different stars? The different
stars, yeah.
And how different are they?
Yeah. So let me tell you what I observed. Well, not myself, but Delta Mite UCSC. So what we did was we observed Tycho, which is supernova remnant.
Yeah.
And in fact, we discovered a 3.5 keV line from Tycho, which was actually surprising because Tycho is a 1a supernova that is predicted not to produce any potassium almost. And so it was like, whoa, there's potassium there, which goes to show that, yeah, we don't really understand how this works.
So, but then the potassium to, iron ratio or something else, is that, how different is that from the sun in Tycho?
It's, so the differences that we observe there, for example, for sulfur to potassium are about a factor of 10. Compared to solar.
Okay.
Yeah. So, for example, sulfur seems to be always underabundant, and potassium seems to be always overabundant in what we've, what we've looked at.
But the new generation asteroids thing that has some much better resolution, right, will solve the issue. The atomic one.
Maxime, you're telling my conclusions before I get there. But yes, that's one way. So let me tell you why we think that the Bulbul predictions were not generous enough. So one thing you can do is you can look at lines that come from the same element. So for example, you can look at hydrogen-like and helium-like calcium lines. And it turns out that the ratio, the theoretical prediction for the ratio of these lines is a very steep function of temperature, as you can see here. Okay, that's log scale. This is a linear scale. Very steep dependence on temperature. So you go up there. These are both pretty bright lines. You measure them. And that gives you an indication of what the temperature of sort of the effective temperature of the system is. So we did that for their cluster sample. And that's about here. Now, the temperatures they used for their sample are here. Okay, so they're much larger. And that's important because potassium has a line brightness that depends on temperature very steeply as well. And it turns out that if you use this temperature to predict potassium instead of this, you get a prediction that is a factor of 4 smaller. If you use this temperature, your prediction is a factor of 13 smaller. So what we think was the case was that Bobo et al., for whatever reason, they employed systematically large temperatures, which made them conclude that potassium is unlikely to explain the 3.5 keV line. We think that, you know, before calling dark matter, you got to be generous. And there's evidence that they have not been generous enough in allowing for a broad enough range of temperatures.
But what was their well, maybe you don't want to get into that.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a minute, what was their position? I mean, they didn't just guess those temperatures. They did infer it from some...
Yeah, from some combinations of lines. Again, the key assumption was solar abundances. Uh-huh. So they use, you can imagine that you can do this for this ratio, but you measure a bunch of lines. So what they did was they had a sort of a black box, my understanding, they had a black box, you fed to this black box a bunch of line ratios, and the black box optimized the temperatures that explained that pattern of ratios. Okay, and so it just takes, for example, one element that is systematically offset, and we think sulfur is systematically offset, for example, and that biases you towards one thing or another. And so even if you have this, everything else pushes you in that direction, if you know what I mean. So that's, we think, what happened. So that was our key message. So the line is there, but potassium, presumably, if you're generous enough, explains the story. So what are the other tests? Well, number one, you can look elsewhere. You can look at other systems. Is there a 3.5 keV line somewhere else than clusters or the galaxy? And number two, you can use something different than spectrum. Can I get to that? So looking elsewhere looked pretty depressing. Okay, there's no signal from dwarf galaxies. These are dark matter-dominated systems. They're bright enough that if that was dark matter, you should have seen a signal at the 9 sigma level, and you don't see anything. Then people stacked galaxies like the Milky Way that have low enough plasma temperatures that you just don't get to 3.5 keV. So that's great. You don't have all these complicated pattern of lines that you have in clusters. There's no line there. Also, we showed that there's actually no line in M31. And that Boyarsky et al. Had seen a line there, mostly because they had stacked enough faint lines that they had created a spurious line at 3.5 keV. So, number two, what else could you do with photons that is not looking at a spectrum? Well, you've got two pieces of information when you get a photon. One is the energy, the spectrum. The second information is where the photon came from. So you could use morphology. So you could look or try to look at where the 3.5 keV photons came from. And that's a tricky business because this is a faint line.
Sometimes you have done it when you look at the center of the galaxy, no?
Right. But that's, you know, you just, okay, you look within some big, yeah. But in some sense, we did that. So we did a better job, and we subtracted off the continuum that is below the line. And we did it in 4 different ways. This is really tricky because the line is, you know, maybe 10% of the photon. So you got to be careful. But we tried with many different sidebands to subtract off the continuum. And we always found this quadrupolar structure in the Milky Way. And that was remarkable, mostly because there are very bright lines that looked exactly the same. So it kind of convinced us that wherever you had metal emitting, you know, metals emitting atomic de-excitation lines, that was exactly the same place where you got these 3.5 keV photons. So that was kind of depressing. So we looked at Perseus, where, again, you've got a bright 3.5 keV line. And It looked a little more spherically symmetric, so that's good, but it's actually not good. It's not good because this blob corresponds with the cluster's cool core. And that is a much smaller object than the core of the dark matter halo. So in other words, the cluster, had these photons come from dark matter decay, would have looked a lot broader. So in fact, let me give you a more detailed picture of what I mean. So this gray band indicates with uncertainty, with systematic uncertainty, where the 3.5 keV photons come from as functional radius in degrees. And the prediction for dark matter is this red line. So you should have seen a lot more photons here, for example,
how
than you do.
How significant is this? I mean, you don't have enough. I mean, how significant is to say in terms of sigmas? Because
yeah.
It may not be. I mean, I don't think you have enough data to say conclusively yet, right?
Yeah, we think we do. In fact, we think that using morphology, we are able to put the strongest possible constraints on the lifetime of stellar neutrinos. So we actually translated that in sigmas, or if you want, in constraints on the mass versus mixing angle stellar neutrinos. And we actually do a good job. So in other words, what you do is suppose you had a lifetime. So you should have seen a signal to a certain level, and you compare to data, and you don't, and so you can put constraints. And we did that exercise. But there's a caveat. And the caveat is that you can think of this 3.5 keV line as possibly originating not from a decay, but from the conversion of axion-like particles. So think of a pseudoscalar that gets converted in magnetic fields to a photon with exactly the same energy. So this is kind of a Primakov effect. And in that case, you only get an emission at 3.5 keV where you have strong enough magnetic fields, the cool core of a cluster, place where you've got very large magnetic fields. The Milky Way, not enough. You don't have large enough scale magnetic fields to do the trick. So that's perfectly fine. So we think that the 3.5 keV line is perfectly compatible, unless it's really potassium, with axion-like particle decay. So now, what comes next? And of course, Maxime has already uncovered the killer. So the killer would be AstroH. AstroH is a Japanese mission with some NASA component to it that has a soft X-ray spectrometer with an exquisite energy resolution. And so what it will do are two things. Number one, unless the line is exactly where the potassium line is, we will see an offset, and that's good. Number two, we'll actually see a broadening of the line if it's from dark matter. Because the energy resolution is so good that you can actually tell that dark matter lives in a gravitational potential well, so it has a finite velocity dispersion that broadens the line enough that the instrument will tell it apart from the thermal broadening that you get from elemental lines. So that's great. That's going to be the end of the story. So now, the darkest signal of all in this business is a third signal, and the last one I'd like to discuss with you today, which is the galactic center gamma ray axis. So in what sense it is the darkest? Well, if you look at the fraction of papers that have thought about dark matter and explaining the signal, the positron axis is a really pretty low, 78%. The 3.5 keV line, 85%. But the gamma ray galactic center axis has 95% of the papers talking about dark matter. So what is this? Well, if you look at the gamma ray sky with the Fermi Large Area Telescope, and you use standard diffuse models, so standard models for the diffuse gamma ray emission in a galaxy, you see an axis. Okay, many different groups have pinpointed this axis over time. The first one was led by Dan Hooper, my friend at Fermilab, and hence the name Hooperon, the particle that possibly mediates this. So this hit the news, Scientific American, New Scientist. But then The Economist reported on this. And I got nervous because The Economist has the tendency to get things right. And so this is a very old issue of The Economist. So this was from where I was in college. So this is not a post-diction. Okay, this guy had just entered politics. And so The Economist gets things right. So what produces the galactic center axis? Well, it turns out that in this case, fitting the axis with dark matter annihilation is really easy. It's like a piece of cake. You know, you take your vanilla dark matter model, and it pretty much works. Okay, the morphology is okay. It's nicely spherically symmetric. Spectrum is just fine. You know, you take, again, your neutralino dark matter, and it works. Constraints from other things are still sort of okay. You know, you can debate how much tension there is with things like dwarf galaxy non-observation or, you know, radio constraints or CMB, but they're also, you know, you can work around those. Interestingly, the most obvious astrophysical counterparts do not work. So there's no obvious way in which, for example, unresolved pulsars, so unresolved populations producing gamma rays in the center of the galaxy, so things that you don't really individually resolve, well, they don't quite work. Okay, the morphology is wrong. The spectrum pretty much doesn't work, and there's strong indications there's not enough pulsars to do the trick. So what produces the galactic center axis? Do we really have a strong case for dark matter? Well, I think that's the wrong question. I think it's the wrong question to ask what produces the galactic center axis. I think the real question is the axis there? In other words, do we have models of the diffuse emission that are good enough to conclusively think that there is an axis? So there's two key ingredients to how you produce diffuse gamma rays in the galaxy. The first one is basically the same ingredient that produces positrons. You got high energy cosmic ray protons hitting gas in the ISM and producing neutral pions, and these decay into two photons. You also have Bremsstrahlung. And number two, you have cosmic ray electrons that inverse Compton abscatter primarily starlight in the galaxy to gamma ray energy. So these are the two key things that we think describe the large-scale diffuse gamma ray emission in the galaxy. So all of the groups that find an axis assume a number of things in describing the diffuse axis emission. Number one, they all take a two-dimensional gas density distribution. So what that means is that they assume cylindrical symmetry, okay? So they get two coordinates, z and r, and they average over angles. Number two, they do the same thing for cosmic ray transport. So they do transport in two dimensions. And number three, they assume that everything is in steady state. So they don't care about time-dependent effects. They don't care about things that inject cosmic rays at some point in time, such that the cosmic rays have not gone into the steady state yet. And number four, they use very simplistic cosmic ray source distributions. You know, things like r to some powers times e to the minus something, okay? Motivated by where supernova remnants are, for sure, but this, you know, are cosmic rays really there? So every assumption we've come with my group to the conclusion costs a systematic effect that is of the same order of magnitude as the size of the axis. So every one, two, three, and four, every step, every assumption has the same systematic cost as the size of the axis. So what we've been doing with my students and postdocs has been trying to work towards the next generation of diffuse gamma ray models, trying to overcome these four deficiencies. So how do you do that? Well, number one, you stick in three-dimensional gas density models. Number two, you stick in three-dimensional transport. It's a pain because it's much easier to solve differential equations in 2D than in 3D. But you got to do it. We think we got to do it.
The problem is you don't actually know the three-dimensional distribution model.
That's right. But do you just give up and do it in 2D? Then we also realized that transients, so cosmic rays that gets injected at some point in time and that have not yet reached steady state are actually very important. And I'll explain why. Primarily, the reason is that unlike electrons, protons are very inefficient in losing energy. They lose energy very slowly. And we know from the observation of the Fermi bubbles that there have been injection of cosmic rays in the galaxy on scales of about 1 million years. And cosmic ray protons lose energy on much, much longer scales. Number four, we try to use physically motivated cosmic ray distribution models, sources, where we stuck the sources. And I'll get to that. So we have some preliminary results. And again, these are preliminary results. But for example, what's the impact of using 3D models? So we have ways to map, for example, where H2 is, where molecular hydrogen is. And if you stick those distributions instead of the 2D kind of average distributions over angles, these are the effects you get. They're 3 to 10%. Okay, you've got some under estimates here, overestimates there, some stuff in the galactic center, 3 to 10%. Now, 3D cosmic ray propagation. So you leave everything the same, but you do things in 3D instead of 2D. Okay? And again, you get stuff that does look a little bit different, and the effect is a few percent. Again, to be compared with an axis that is on the order of few to 10% of the diffuse emission. Number three, again, we know that there's been cosmic ray injection episodes in the galaxy. You observe these lobes of gamma rays and X-rays and radio called the Fermi bubble. So does that imply anything for the galactic center? Well, we showed in a paper with my student Eric Carlson that, in fact, you can even almost match the galactic center axis by just postulating that there's some cosmic ray protons injected relatively recently, so, you know, maybe 100,000 years ago to a million years ago in the center of the galaxy. And there's a simple reason why that works. The axis has a 1 over r squared dependence. Now, if you blow stuff up, you get 1 over r squared. But surprisingly, the spectrum almost works pretty well. So that motivates, you know, just considering the possibility that there's been cosmic ray injection in the galactic center. So why should we just give up on that possibility when we discuss the diffuse emission in the galaxy? So what do I mean by physically motivated cosmic ray source distributions? Well, what we did was to place a fraction of the cosmic ray sources in the galaxy where the densest gas regions are. So what we did was to look at how much of the axis was left over when you stuck a fraction between 3% and 30% of the cosmic ray sources inside dense H2 regions. So why do we do that? Well, because dense H2 regions, molecular clouds, are the places where stars form, are the places where supernova go off, and are the places where cosmic rays are accelerated. So it's a natural thing to stick a fraction of the cosmic rays in those regions. And if you do that, and this was, you know, completely surprising to us, we don't see yet a good reason why that works, but the axis dies. When you stick 20% of cosmic rays inside H2 regions, we see the axis basically go away. So should you take this, you know, as the resolution of the galactic center axis? No, because we don't know whether this model produces a decent enough large-scale diffuse emission model. So we want to make sure that that's the case. We want to see whether or not, if you do this, you not only get rid of the axis, but you also reproduce, you know, all the other features of the diffuse emission in the galaxy. And that's unclear at the moment, so we don't know if that works. But it's intriguing. It's intriguing that this galactic center axis is unstable against, for example, sticking cosmic ray sources inside molecular clouds. Yes?
Simple mic question. What about the gamma rays that come from black hole? Sagittarius A star.
Yeah.
It has accretions.
Yeah.
Jets, blah, blah.
Yeah. So we've worked on it as well. So what's the systematic effect associated with the point source subtraction of Sag A star? So that's a non-trivial thing because Fermi has a pretty good angular resolution, but the angular resolution degrades at the energies of interest for the axis. So it's not an easy task. And we do see the axis at very large angular scales. So that cannot be the whole story. But understanding in detail that source will be key. And so that's why, for example, the Cherenkov telescope array is going to be so important, because they do the trick of having a very good angular resolution and going down in energy enough that we'll actually be able to do point source subtraction for Sag A star much better. Well, not down to that scale, but we'll get down to a scale where the uncertainty in the, say, 1 degree region around Sag A star, you know, will be understood much better. So I continue to remain skeptic about establishing a conclusive dark matter detection with gamma rays from the galactic center. Yes?
So
I don't have a good physical understanding other than the fact that we know there's clouds aligned along the line of sight. And so if you think about a nearby cloud and you stick cosmic rays in that cloud, then you know you would expect something that extends to large angular scales that is not at all in the galactic center, and you know that could fuel some spherically symmetric, roughly emission in the direction.
But I mean, these H2 regions are correlated with the galactic rays, right?
Right. So if you just go back to this slide, you can see that. So in this map, we're here, and you see that there's stuff. There's stuff along the line of sight towards the galactic center. So how much, you know, we have a large catalog of molecular clouds that we use to do this. And so, you know, if you take some over density here, that could reasonably contribute a good amount. So that's, you know, at this point, that's what I have to say about it. So is it possible at all to use gamma rays to detect dark matter? And I think that the answer is yes. The answer is yes, because a monochromatic gamma ray line with a diffuse morphology, so not a point source, with a diffuse morphology, that's dark matter. There's no question about it. So we actually detected such a line at 130 GeV. That was discovered by this German guy, Christoph Weniger, who recently hired as a postdoc one of my students. Unfortunately, the line was a statistical fluke. So it turned out that little bump was way too narrow right off the bat. The significance went actually down with time instead of increasing. And it's actually not at all there with this new software analysis tool called PASS8. So that's too bad. So there is a way, but we're not quite there yet. So cosmic ray positron axis, I think we've got a very good case for pulsars. The 3.5 keV line, axion-like particles work, but potassium also does work. And the galactic center axis, there's work to do. We know in which direction, but you know it's still bewildering, and it could be dark matter. So what else? Well, I think what else at this point in time means the Large Hadron Collider, RAN 2, could be very, very exciting very, very soon. So I'm excited about that. Radio surveys. Radio surveys are coming online soon, and they're large-scale maps of the sky at frequencies that could inform us not only about WIMPs, but about a bunch of different particles that could decay at radio frequencies, or that could yield secondary radiation at radio frequencies. Astro-H, again, for the 3.5 keV line. CTA, understanding such a star better. And of course, generation 2 direct detection, stuff that is going to go on at SNOLAB, super CDMS, LZ, the Noble gas detectors. Those are going to carve into the portion of parameter space where there's very, very good theoretical reasons to think that the dark matter might give a signal. So let me close with a quote from Painter, René Magritte, that I think is really appropriate for indirect dark matter detection. And he says that everything we see hides another thing, and we always want to see what is hidden by what we see. I thank you very much for your attention. Maxime.
I have the following question. As I know, whenever we look at any decay in the frequency of radiation coming from astrophysical sources and so on, we usually discover this or that anomaly, right? And you went over a number of these decays. I was wondering if anyone searched for something unusual below the KV, right? All this boo-boo at all. Plots, they all cut out there, right? And they look, but has anyone done such studies in the UV in the optical or something to look for something really unusual sequences?
So you can use, folks have looked at axion decay from clusters in the optical. So they've looked at clusters and they've looked for anomalous lines at EV frequencies.
From 100 EV to KV.
Right. So there are instruments, EUV, for example, is one of those. You can use infrared cameras to look for lines. How well motivated is a particle that decays it. That doesn't matter, maybe.
Aside,
yeah.
Right?
Let's leave it aside. I agree with you. So I was involved in searching for dark matter from dwarf galaxies in radio, which I think is very interesting because, again, dwarf galaxies are very quiet. There's no reason to expect any radio emission. In fact, we didn't see any. But, you know, again, you can use that information. Of course, most radio telescopes are at one frequency, so seeing a line is not possible unless you're very lucky. And so, you know, you can think about models where you've got some secondary yield at radio frequencies, and we've done that, and we thought about, you know, the issue of transport of cosmic rays in dwarf galaxies, which is a very hairy issue. So as you took away from my talk, we don't really understand what cosmic rays do in the galaxy, in our own galaxy. Go figure what they do in dwarf galaxies. Don't even know if there's gas at all. So it's there's a number of questions, and there's a you know, I was talking to Rob about the impact of DES, the Dark Energy Survey, discovering these new dwarf galaxies in the southern sky. You never know where new exciting things would come from. It is important to keep the communication channels with astronomers open, because you know they gotta know that you know, any line could be exciting. we like lines, so you know that message should be out there, and we should use anything we have. Yes.
So this is all very, very interesting, very impressive. So I think you managed to debunk all the dark matter. And
I don't know.
I don't know if you want to take credit for that, but I'm happy to give it to you.
Thank you.
So the only thing was, I guess I wasn't quite convinced, but was this thing about the quadrupolar asymmetry,
yeah,
of dark matter annihilation, or sorry,
DK, yeah.
KV line, yes. KV line around galactic center. And I mean, so the galactic disk is obviously asymmetric. So, and this, and when you get close to the center, I mean, this stars dominate the gravity. So there's no reason for dark matter distribution to be a spherical symmetric while that.
That's true. But would you expect the dark matter to be up and down?
Up and down? Okay. I guess I don't expect it.
So observationally, you might ask a question, okay, do you really understand what X-rays do as they go through the galactic disk? And that is actually tricky. Because at 3.5 keV, there's not a lot of absorption, but there is some absorption.
Okay.
So you might wonder, okay, maybe you just
didn't
take that into account. But I don't think so, because we've looked at other lines that are bright,
uh-huh,
and at a number of different frequencies, large enough energies just plow through and they don't get absorbed. So I'm not really concerned about absorption.
Right.
I mean, of course, we did try to take it into account, but I don't think that's
right,
a problem. Yeah.
So I think it goes in the wrong way.
It goes in the wrong direction. I mean, it's not a dark disk. We'd like, you know, give this seminar at Harvard, and I would have been happy to convey the message that indeed, Lisa, there's a dark disk, but no.
Not the dark disk. Okay. Cool. Okay.
Yes.
The galaxy cluster collisions have been in use.
So, yeah.
I suppose the cluster of Babel 5-0. And Babel 3827. The latter two cases, dark matter appears in the wrong place.
Yeah. So you know, I think that's one interesting direction. So thinking about what dark matter might do with itself. It's a self-interaction of dark matter. So usually the cross sections that you need to have any appreciable effect are very large. So you need basically, you know, strong interaction, geometric cross sections to have any collisional effect that you can hope to observe in things like cluster collision. So that might be possible. I mean, I can give you models where that happens. But at the moment, I don't think that there's any real compelling reason to bang your head on the wall trying to build such models based on cluster collisions that, you know, where the dark matter is not really where it should be. These are based on re-cleansing that comes with a bag of important systematic effects. So do we have all those under control? It's, you know, it's not my area of expertise, but I wouldn't bet much.
Yeah, but we have to keep pushing the original force to fly through the cluster.
So actually, we're running into lunch now. So Stefano's going to be here till 1:30,
yes,
so I encourage all of you to continue asking questions and discuss afterwards, but let's thank him again.